I was thinking maybe we would just sort of chat and catch up. We haven't talked in a while, and there's a lot to cover. Yeah. I don't know. Is there anything catch particular?
How many closures were there this long weekend? I mean, I lost track. Like, I couldn't, personally, as someone living in BC, I couldn't find all the information, like, without looking at your data, where all those
such a
closures
mess
were.
Now.
I know.
There were at least six, maybe more, sort of across. So this, for the long weekend, we saw that in, like, the last week, they updated for both alerts. In Chimanas, so there are health centers there, the Chimanas Healthcare Center and the Cormorant Island Health Center. They both extended those closures through the middle to the end of September. So in terms of the island health, that's definitely being impacted until at least the end of September, which of course a lot of them were trying to say this was like summer vacations, but now that summer's over, you are still seeing the and they are still trying to not admit it's COVID. we also see that UBC Hospital has that shortened hours. They cut the 2 hours off. But in terms of this weekend, we also saw closures specifically in Ashcroft over the weekend, more closures in Clearwater, which they've been closed overnight for weeks, you know, like 4 to 6 weeks now, I think, in a row. And then Mackenzie, they don't like update theirs through the normal website for the interior or the health district. So they have their like own thing that they release when they have closures. So when I went back to it, there was like 17 closures I missed since July 7th or something. So yeah, we're just seeing like the persistent nature of these closures now that are keeping on, but also sort of that broach now into the less rural areas, which of course, now that Ontario's hit, everybody's talking about it, right? Like BC had closures for much longer before Ontario, but Ontario is a much bigger population. So once it hits there, of course, we see it's much more in the media now. But for BC, it's, you know, we've been seeing these closures since the end of 2021.
Yes, and it's gotten so bad in those areas that, I mean, I just read recently the mayors of all those small towns are banding together to address this issue because they realize, you know, you can't be a mayor of any community if the community is going to collapse.
Well, and there's one that is active on Twitter, Merlin Blackwell, who's the mayor of Clearwater. So he's someone mm-hmm. I've sort of touched base with on and off in the last, at least over this summer, because of how badly Clearwater's been hit. And he's one of the mayors that's also sort of part of that coalition to try and get the rural services stabilized. And I do see his tweets that are, you know, very hopeful sometimes. And, you know, today or yesterday, they were hoping to get more permanent staff. I am really sort of, I'll say I'm cautious with my hope towards the Clearwater solutions, though, because it seems like every couple of weeks we seem to have a solution. But then by the end of the week, we're again seeing those closures in Clearwater. So, you know, as schools have opened, I'm very, very worried about what the hospitals are going to look like in the winter. Anyone who's looking at the data across time, which they do make difficult, even though it's relatively simple data, we're seeing the highest deaths that we have across the pandemic in 2022 as we go along, right? Like in Alberta, we had like 42 people the prior week, and in BC, it was like 45. So, and that's a week. That's bonkers, right? Like, that's way more than we had dying in the summer of 2020 or in the summer of 2022. We have like hundreds of hospitalized in BC, which is just astronomically more than we had the summers previous because we were doing we still had some sort of precautions in this sort of let it rip policy now is, I still don't even think we've really seen the full impact of it because, you know, we started lifting masks and some of those things in March and we've seen that consistent sort of 30% of the staff sick since that time, but now sort of taking back all measures in all places and all these things, moving indoors for the fall now. I worry what that's going to look like for us all.
What frustrates me the most is that there's no discussion about these high mortality rates. They're not pointing out the fact that there have been more dead people in 2022 than there have been in 2020 and 2021 put together.
I have the BC Hospital data pulled up and I'm looking at the situation reports. And every week I sort of do a tally of the deaths they're relating back to these age groups just to see. So if we just look at the last situation report, it's over 40 deaths in that 1 week period that they're reporting on. And we see one of those deaths in the 20 to 29 category, one death in the 40-49, one in the 50 to 59, eight deaths in the 60 to 69, 10 in the 70 to 79, 16 in the 80 to 89, and 16 in the age 90 plus. When we, you know, like I calculated a while ago, it was quite a while ago now, the proportion of those over like 90 that we've killed in Canada with COVID. And it was like over 1% of the census population of that age group we had killed with COVID at that time. And these numbers are not giving me hope that we're not doing that even more so now with these older populations. It's really tragic that we're sort of letting these individuals succumb to this. And we see that with the lowered life expectancy, right, coming out of the stats in the United States. And anyone that's surprised hasn't been paying attention. I would say that for illicit drug users, it was being impacted before, and we have seen overdoses grow, but they were on that trajectory too. So I want to say that excess deaths isn't even reported into this, and there's even more so in there, both of those sort of drug toxic deaths and as well of COVID. So like we have these multifaceted public health crises that are ongoing sort of together and impacting one another. And it's just getting worse and worse. Like we've treated the populations that are most impacted by this worse and worse across time. And we're seeing this with this like rancid individualism that's coming through right now, and people selfish right now, right? On a sort of societal level. And so I made that tweet this morning or yesterday, it was about masks not being a lockdown, because like the language use, we've gotten so wild now with the way people use languages of like, we're never going to go back to lockdown, blah, blah, blah. And most of the time we're like, we just want like an indoor mask mandate. So like masks vulnerable are people are being coughed on, which is currently happening. Or like I go to my GP that I don't have to worry, I'm going to freaking pick something up as an immune compromised person. But that's where we're at, right? And I thought the point was for us to heal some of these things, not to like go back to the normal that was already killing people. But unfortunately, as we've seen and as we know, we not only went back to that normal, but we like really fucking dug in, and we were like, yeah, we're definitely going to kill the compromised and vulnerable, and just fucking went with it.
Yeah, when they say the quiet parts out loud, you're just like, huh?
Seriously, what was that lady? Who was that lady? Staff said her tweet, the one with the Met, the museum lady, who like yes. Her post was like, I've been bullying them for 2 years to reopen and to take away masks. I'm like, what's wrong with people right now?
But she was gloating. She was proud of herself for being a bully.
Yeah, and not only proud, but they have the audacity right now to demand that we have to like them if they still act like this, and like don't have the right to sort of excuse ourselves from being around people or accepting that. And they want to go back to normal. But those of us who are compromised, who know compromised, who, I don't know, just care about vulnerable populations, we never needed that, right? And we saw a way to help people, and we never needed to be convinced of that. So to have such a big portion of the population see what we see as a very minor inconvenience that could help so many turn away from that and actively turn away from that, I mean, it's horrifying at a societal level right now.
It makes me really wonder, like, where is the tipping point? Because, you know, we're already seeing pilots crashing, pilots falling asleep, just because people want to pretend it's 2019 and it's travel.
This is the hard part for me, yeah. Now, is that literally the people yelling about the delays are the people that are yelling about protections, but it would help there be less delays. I don't understand anymore. They're working against their own self-interest in this point. even economically, right? And we see that. We see that now with some of the financial structures and the financial writers that are starting to talk about long COVID now, that are starting to talk about the actual economic impact and the financial impact that there's going to be on the workforce because of this. And it's nice they're recognizing now, but fuck, would have been nice before.
Yeah, BCTF just announced there's going to be a teacher shortage in the entire province for this school year. Major one.
Really?
Really? You don't say. You know how many teachers under healthcare workers with the second highest work safe claims?
We only had so many people, right? That this is the thing, is like when the blood clinic, Canadian Blood Services, when they decided to lift the mask mandate, and we were like, okay, in the least judgmental way possible, do you actually think that the people who are not wearing masks and don't care that much are the ones that are going to come in and like make up the supply or the difference that's happening there versus the people that want masks? And I don't know anymore if it was they genuinely thought that or they just don't care to, if they care to collapse it, because we know like privatization is happening as we speak. But it was, and then it happened exactly as we said, right? Like they're behind in so many donors now, because what a surprise. Those people that don't like to mask didn't sweep in to fill all the blood donation appointments. So
it's not in their psychological profile to give and be selfless, to give blood. If they can't give a crap about putting on a respirator to prevent a pandemic from continuing and killing their immunocompromised neighbers. Right? Like, you're right. What were they thinking?
We found out, though, Mel, is that those same people that we're talking about, a large portion of our health systems and public health stratus are those people as well.
Yes.
And they're making those policies and they're now making decisions. And we have people like, you know, Prasad out there that are talking about how people think they're going to know they're going to have a heart attack from a CO2 monitor, and just like making the most asinine statements because he's become some sort of really, really enjoys the attention that he gets on the internet, I think, as well as many of the other people that are involved in this right now. It's really sad. Right? Because they're impacting so much right now, and our whole systems are sort of falling to these selfish actors, I think is the best way to call them. And I don't know how we recover from that.
It makes me wonder if all this minimizing, and it's coordinated and organized, because there's a reason why it's no longer in our news about COVID. Like, are they preparing us for learned helplessness? So they're making people resign and saying, hey, you know what? I can't protect myself. I can't protect my family. So I might as well give up.
Well, it's not even like that anymore though, because they've put us in a position where they are stating that we have to do this personal risk assessment and keep ourselves alive while simultaneously encouraging the healthcare system to collapse. So we don't even have a healthcare to rely on now and do personal risk assessments, because it's not even safe, right? Like, we see the deaths that are happening. There's now been multiple deaths, and the recent death of a child under 12 months old, right, that had a cardiac event in Barrier, and there was no ambulance. Well, and then just days later, a story, you know, that I have pulled up and is under the BC Hospital data tag about a woman who had a stroke and was raped by the hospital and went hours before she was actually able to get to the hospital, right? It's the systems aren't there. And even if you end up in the system, you have to worry now that you're going to get COVID because they're not even using the proper precautions.
Dr. Kimberly Prather and Dr. Rosenthal just like tweeted an article today about the cost of a CR box, a Corsi Rosenthal box every classroom, how much it would cost. Literally for a year for a child to have clean air in their classroom if they had CR boxes provided is less than $4 a kid.
Right. And then I also saw posts out today from the same minimizers that talk about everything about how we shouldn't be worrying about putting CR boxes in our classrooms, and that, you know, those, that's not something we should be focusing on. I mean, that's bonkers. We've not only lost public health with regard to COVID, we lost public health with regard to prevention in general, right?
Yeah.
You have people out there making all sorts of sweeping statements, whereas, like, we know good air quality is good for your freaking brain. Like, this is not a COVID-related matter. Like, the more oxygen we can get up to that brain and those growing brains of children and workers, they're going to function better, you dumbasses. Like, this is beyond ridiculous, where we're taking, like, basic things that could be helpful in sustaining our entire community and our individual selves and refusing to use them because cheap, man.
Right, the 60 million that our Ministry of Education provided for schools, that instead of, you know, for supplies and field trips, hey, thanks, send them on field trips on a crowded bus into like some other area. Why can't you use that 60 million for CR boxes and improve ventilation? Or how about that? What happened to all the federal money we got from the feds?
Oh, no.
We what happened?
About that yet, have we?
No, we need to talk about that.
So let's start with, what was our beautiful surplus that Horgan reported? What was it, like 1.3 billion of a surplus at BC?
Yeah, he's so proud of himself. Big pat on the back for saving 1.3 billion.
And so first of all,
doctors are not getting paid.
Yeah, first of all, everyone was like, what the fuck, bro? You just said we have no money, and there's a lot of systems right now that could use some money anyway. But then the Auditor General comes out and says, yeah, it looks like there's like 6 billion missing from your accounting. Where's that?
There's a lot of money missing. What is happening? Like, why is there not more oversight? $6 billion right. That can go into healthcare, that can go into education. Like, what is happening?
Right. We have no idea. That's the thing. I can't give you any answers because we have no freaking idea. This money got pooled in and we have nothing to show for it.
No. I saw that one article where these Ukrainian refugees were telling other Ukrainian refugees not to come to BC because they can't find anywhere they can afford
Correct. To I saw rent. That too. They can't right? find anything to rent.
Yeah.
It's happening. International students too. I've yes. seen a number of stories from international students on podcasts that despite like being here for multiple years, like fourth year, like PhD students that are when they go home in the summer and then they come back, they're becoming unable to come back because they're unable to actually find housing that they can afford in any sort of way to continue going to the university, which is, you know, tragic that we've allowed people to come here and encourage them to do their education there. And then we have these barriers that we've put in those systems that don't allow them to continue on. I mean, it's horrible. I can't imagine the stress that that puts on those students.
But it's just literally policy failure after policy failure, from housing to education.
What policy? Healthcare management. You're being a little generous there. There yeah, is no that policy.
They actually have a plan? No. Unless they are intending to fuck up intentionally this badly, because people who can't even work in the downtown core can't even afford to live in the downtown core. So you have people who can't live in the city, who can't afford to live in the city, who can't afford to eat. Like, they're not going to live there. So what's going to happen? You're going to have these empty, dead cities where stores are closing. There's no community. There's no forward thinking that these people do. Is that where the $6 billion went? They just like put it in their pockets and they're like,
they forget in their offshore that the account. World is run by the lemmings, right? Like, we are lemmings and we do things, and they forget that we don't do things sometimes. And this is why there's been so much of a push, right, for like socialist based movements and those worker based movements right now, in terms of pushing back, because so much of this is about the fact that we have no power and control over it, and sort of corporations in the capitalist based system have put us in a place where many of us are going to work in jobs that are putting us at COVID risk simply because financially there's just not a lot of other options, right? And that's huge amounts of the workforce that's actually dying from COVID right now, or the populations that are dying in long-term care homes, that there are no other options, right? Like, there's There's like three homes and the places that they can go to, and they're all have the same BC policies right now as it is, and they can't get funding to go anywhere else. So it's like the people that are in those positions that are relying on the cause of these are the ones that have no say. And that's
what. Did you see the news coming out of Ontario about how their CMOH is saying you don't even need to isolate anymore when you're positive? You no longer need to isolate, even though you're testing positive on your rapid test, which they're going to discontinue by the end of this year, where it's not going to make it available. And because that's what the U.S. is doing right now. They're saying is the rapid tests are not going to be available anymore.
Oh, right? That's why I do grab boxes whenever I'm at the pharmacy in Alberta. Yes. Because if Ontario's done it before Alberta, I highly suspect Alberta will be doing it soon, because Alberta's not going to keep a freedom away from their people. So I'm worried we're going to lose testing as well. I'm very, very concerned about that. And even now, like, there's technicalities, so you can go back to work within about 48 hours if you have two negative rats after a positive rat. And we all know that the rats are only so effective, especially in the way of not catching those positives when it's not at that infectious load yet. But I really, to be honest, Mel, I wonder who's actually using them. Like, how many cases are just not being reported? Because I'm still hearing people coughing all over the offices, that people are still traveling, doing these things that when they were sort of given the approval by public health, when they were given the approval by those in power to not worry about it, to say that we're going back to normal, that sort of we're not dealing with this anymore, we don't need to mask, we don't need to do those things. It's giving them permission, right, to not test, to not do those things, because it's not a big deal. And that's why I get really, really fucking angry about people like Vinay Prasad that are out there putting this information out in his stupid little circle jerk medical blog that he writes to his other fucking minimizers, that, you know, we shouldn't be using things that give us data, like CO2 monitors, that he can't even fucking explain how it works properly in his blog that he writes. You think he'd fact check himself first, but, you know, not important at all. And, you know, discouraging people to use the only tools that we have, right? And that's hard. That's hard for me to see professionals doing, to be honest. Like, I have many words that I would like to offer towards such individuals, but don't do so in the public forum. but if I'm ever in a room with them, they certainly will hear it from my face. So I just, it's so hard. And I've had this the whole pandemic, right, that I never really talk to people at the individual level or talk about it at the individual level, because public health has been such a force for fostering bad science, for fostering and encouraging people to have these individualistic notions and to have these sort of selfish notions and go on with it, right, and say that masks are for just for personal safety. And that's not the case, and that's not what we started out saying either. So it's hard that public health against what we're doing right now, and that feels like an uphill battle, especially when we fucking seen once again that the minimizers get the mic, right? That even after they were wrong for years, that there's minimizers now that are up to the mic being given access to some of the most important people and the most important platforms, that are just doing harm.
I mean, we haven't recorded in about a month because both our families caught COVID, right?
Correct.
I mean, it took me 10 days to clear the virus until I was no longer testing positive on the rapid test. And it's horrible, right? And I can't imagine families knowing this is coming and then school starts tomorrow, right?
It's so scary, too, and I think the reason why many of us, it's so hard on a daily basis, is like the juxtaposition of the people who want to live a normal life with like the fact that we are trying to genuinely like save the lives of people and our loved ones and the vulnerable. And it's so hard to battle that every day. And yeah, like we got COVID. I got COVID for the second time. So my husband got it for the first time, and my son, my 6-year-old, And that was because we don't do a lot of things that aren't outside, that aren't sort of in our safety profile, and we're happy with that. But my husband had to take an airplane because of sort of the custody situation to pick up and drop off his kiddos that were here for a month in the summer. And 48 hours after he got back from the airport, was down with a fever of 102, like really bad strep-like symptoms. And then 48 hours, my son developed 102, and then 24 hours later, it was me. So we all sort of fell to it. And then my husband got an abscess 6 days into it and lost one of his teeth.
Whoa.
One of the molars, because, like, got an infection in his gum out of nowhere. And it blew up, and then he just ended up having the tooth taken out because they had to access it either way. He didn't want to do a root canal. And then my son's asthma was definitely impacted, so he took a lot longer than everybody else to sort of heal, and we had to up his steroid medication, all that sort of stuff. But even then, right, like, when we were dealing with COVID, there was the question of, like, we didn't want to take him to the hospital if it got bad because he had COVID. We didn't want to give that to any other kiddos that are in the hospital seeking treatment, right? Because we know that they're not following airborne protocols, and that that's putting so many other kids at risk that typically will have some sort of disease that's non-fatal, right? That they're going to be okay from. We don't want to give them COVID. But also the situations at the children's departments are just not great, right? The waits are hours, and then you're thinking, okay, so now I have to take my kid with COVID and sit in the emergency room with other sick kids for like 3 hours. Like,
three? I think it's like 7 to 8 now, like, some of the waits at children's. It's horrible here in the Lower Mainland.
Yeah, but it's just that, like, that lack of sort of protocol and all those sorts of things. It's just, it's hard right now for families that are medically compromised to sort of get what they need and not be at risk, and all those sorts of really sad situations that we are seeing continue, right? That in March of 2022, most of the provinces pulled their indoor mask mandates. We've seen the workforce and all the staffing shortages sort of peak at the levels that they did after that point of like 30%, and all these issues and crises, and they haven't stopped since then. Right? It's been continuous since then. And we talked about this across our episodes in the last 18 months, is that we've plateaued, Mel. The problem is that every time we plateau is we still go back up afterwards, because we do something like, I don't know, move indoors after we took all of the precautions earlier in the year. And now we're going to move indoors, and I'm just worried that once again, we're going to hit that increase, but we're hitting that increase from this very already heightened plateau that we're at, right?
They're supposed to do a press release tomorrow, Penny Vallum and Dr. Bonnie Henry and Avon. Oh, yeah, Dix. About
vaccines and when they'll release them.
Yes.
I bet invitations are going to be involved. I bet ya.
Of course. You're not, I mean, the rules in BC are different from everywhere else in the world. You're not allowed to have your vaccine within 6 months. They, like, they won't let you.
Okay, I'm going to put this out there. And if it happens, it'll be crazy. Let me take that back. It'll be wild. I'm trying not to use the word crazy anymore. That I think I just saw that the UK pulled their acceptance for the under fives for their vaccines. What do you think the chances are that BC follows suit with the UK?
Oh, I believe they will. Because
have they been booking vaccines yet for under five?
They were, and then everything slowed right down, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was this one tweet from, I can't remember from who, but it's from one of our followers, and he was saying that he was trying to take his kids and schedule them for a vaccine. Mm-hmm. BC clinics, and they didn't receive an invitation. They had to call, they insisted, and they went to the clinic. And there were nurses lined up, and there were no kids. They have done such a piss poor job of organizing and communicating this and educating our public that now they're going to say no one showed up to the clinics.
I wonder why. They literally said, saying that kids don't get COVID. Like, our premier said that and never took it back. He has
never retracted that statement, ever.
Oh, and like
our population in BC is so wildly under vaccinated, our kids. that is terrifying what's going to happen this fall for face-to-face. Like, no wonder we have a teacher shortage. They can see their working conditions aren't improving.
What worries me is yes, long COVID, yes, kids getting infected, yes, any deaths that come from that. But also, we know the importance that schools play in terms of transmission. And we know the importance that, you know, household transmission plays in that sort of, in those household attack rates, right? And we are seeing these variants that are increased transmissibility. And now we have schools with no sort of protection measures. So it's just like, what happens when we take the worst of all things and just throw them together, right? Like, that's what this winter is like,
we'll find out. Yeah.
Seriously, this is what it feels like, Mel, to me, is like the people who have sort of been pushing that narrative of like, it's going to be endemic, that it's going to turn into the cold. They're looking at this winter, even though they've looked at the last two winters like this, saying this is that we just have to get through this rough patch of like everyone getting infected and like ripping the Band-Aid off. And then, you know, after this round, that it's just going to be this mild cold. Again, as we've known for 2.5 years, that's just a myth, right? That's like, all viruses don't just become this severe. And the whole problem that we talked about the entire last 2.5 years was that we have based all of that modeling on viruses where we had measures to reduce and prevent the transmission of those sorts of diseases. We have not approached a disease like COVID ever, let alone with the transmission that it's at and the severity that it's still at now in terms of the death rate. Mm-hmm. I don't know what we're brewing, right? And now we're putting this into immunocompromised people, which we know from previous forays into things like HIV that immunocompromised people are just the perfect vectors for brewing these super sort of viruses. So it's like we took all of the things that we learned, we threw it out, and we were like, let's experiment a little and see if it goes our way. And I'm really worried, Mel, that it's not going to go our way.
No. It's not going to go. We have a very scary variant brewing in Argentina, and they say it's Legionnaires, but it's not Legionnaires.
I am hearing multiple things. I've seen nothing solid, so I'm precluding myself from giving an opinion on it at this time. I've seen arguments over whether it is or not, and that there's suggestions that perhaps they're stating it is before they have full evidence. And since I haven't seen the evidence, I'm not going to say. I don't know what it is.
We don't know what it is, but they don't even know what it is. But the scary thing is there's a 30% mortality rate, right? And this is like a pneumonia. They don't know if it's COVID.
More people died since the other day. I think it's up to 6 now.
Yeah. And this is like hemorrhagic fevers too, right? Bleeding out of all your orifices. No,
just a little bleeding out of your eyeball.
Just a little bleeding out of your eyes like anthrax is no big deal.
Hasn't 2022 taught you that we're ready to drink the shit water and bathe
It's just a mild hemorrhagic fever. It's just mild permanent brain damage. It's insane that we know that COVID causes brain damage, shrinks your brains. It's not good for developing brains in little children. And yet they're letting this rip. They're not investing in saving our kids. They're not investing in supporting and saving our health.
Well,
every province run by a conservative premier is determined to let the public health fail. You can see the pattern.
And the people that, like, when the long COVID stuff comes out, they immediately go to, like, this is psychosomatic, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, do you know how much the mental health system costs us annually and how much under serviced health, mental health diagnoses, how much that's costing the economy? Like, what's wrong with these people that look at issues and pretend that if they pretend it's not there, that it's somehow not going to cause destruction to our society? Because that's currently what's happening, is they're literally putting the blinders on and like, it's okay. Like, we'll be fine. Like, this winter's going to be tough. We heard Adrian Dix say that, right? Remember when he came out for one of the last pressers, is that he said, like, we could be in for a difficult winter after saying nothing for months. And it's like, yeah, because they know that this is outrageous, but it's not impacting them. So what do they care?
I mean, how they're dealing with the public health issues, how they're dealing with the homelessness issue, right? They just sweep everyone away and have everyone relocate out of view, right? So out of sight, out of mind. And that's exactly what they're doing to coronavirus too.
And they don't even do that well. No. it's a mess. It's all a mess in BC. Looking at how bad everything is and then them coming out and saying they have a $1.3 billion surplus, I'm like, you should be embarrassed, bro. Like, you should be embarrassed. Where could that money have been solving some of these problems? What is wrong with you that you can't balance your books? And where's the other $5 billion then?
And where's $6 billion? And how many more lives and how many more Canadians would be alive had you done the proper thing and that spent the money where it's supposed to go? Right? We have all these excess deaths that are like, you know, so undercounted. Like, every time I read something from Dr. Moriarty and she's listing our high mortality rates, you know, and you're not even counting the fentanyl overdose crisis we're having.
I just shared this tweet that M sent me. About the vaccines and some of the pediatric changes, if you want to look at that. I'm really wondering what my work site's gonna look like tomorrow. That's on my mind right now. I'm in a shared office, so I have no idea what to expect and what the space looks like or what the protocols with anybody there are like. So I'm very interested to see what that looks like. But we're sort of back at the place where it's like I'm the kooky lady in my N95. So, I don't know. It's wild, Mel. Even at a hospital.
I am wondering what school's going to look like tomorrow, the day after Labor Day, and the amount of reports of people that are going to say they're going to get sick, right? Because then Kathy and Andrew are going to be busy again with BC School COVID Tracker for the third year in a row. And I just wonder, how bad does it have to get until our public health and our leaders do the right thing to protect our most vulnerable?
But I think the bias in our thinking when we talk about that is the thought that it's bad for them, right? Is this idea that how bad does it have to get? And it's like, it doesn't matter how bad it gets, really, in the sense of this system, because that's sort of how it's made, and they're going to keep just trying to plug the holes until it collapses itself. And I mean, that's history, unfortunately, is capitalism stops for nobody, unfortunately. We're watching it collapse. That's the fucking hard part, right? And I think that I walk this balance between my own exceptionalism and like actual recognition of what's happening, because the sheer scale of it is mentally overwhelming for me and emotionally overwhelming on a regular basis, because I don't know how to exist in a world where like 90% of people don't care about killing their fellow human. I genuinely don't know how to do that. So I feel like when I go out into the world, I sort of have to mask up at this point and just sort of survive the best I can and not get ill while I'm out there, and then try and figure out what my future life looks like, because I don't know. It's hard. It's hard. This is the place where many things before, we had disagreements with people, but we didn't talk about our values with a lot of things, and that allowed us to not get into difficult conversations at work, to get into difficult conversations when you're out for drinks on the weekend. But I can't do that anymore when I know that you don't wear a mask. Whether we're at work, whether we're out socially, whether we're out, it doesn't matter where we are. Like, you're showing me sort of what you think of that. And if I then bring to you information about, you know, disability, about equity, about these things, and then you choose to not use that information, yes, that's your choice. Absolutely. Yes, that's your freedom. But our moral structure is so different between one another, that I'm genuinely not interested in a relationship with that person. And unfortunately, that's a large portion of the population right now. So
far. Right? Yeah, it's just everyone's true colors have shown from where they stand on this issue. It's like whether or not you care, whether other people are going to hurt.
Putting empathetic people in particular who are already prone to that sensitivity within the world is putting them into this moral injury position, right? That a lot of those people that are sort of in caregiving professions that want to help the vulnerable that are pushing this, it's just moral injury daily on a regular basis, 24/7, because they're screaming to the world, like, we're killing people right now. We're killing the compromised. Everything's getting worse. And in turn, they're seeing people turn and be like, so what? Not my problem, right? And like, that's the moral distress associated with that and being unable to change society right now. It's so overwhelming for many of us.
It is. It is overwhelming. The tweets I read about parents with their concerns and their anxieties about school starting tomorrow, and the teachers that have and are feeling so burnt out that they don't even know if they want to start the next school year. That takes a psychological toll on me too, because I feel for my colleagues that have to go in and be underfunded and at all times, and you wonder how many are actually going to make it through another school year. Right. And I worry about the parents too, because it's not sustainable to have your child consistently sick and infect a whole family. I mean, people only have so many sick days. What are they supposed to do?
Well, there's no plan for them, right? And that's sort of the point of this, is that those who are most impacted by it have the least say in the policies, even though they have the most direct impact by said policies, because that's the joy of this system, where it's essentially making use of their human capital, unfortunately. And yeah, I worry. You know, my mom left this weekend to go back to BC, so she's back in BC now with my grandpa. And you know, I've tried to impart the knowledge that I can about COVID while she was here, but it's like, I know surgical mask, right? Like, I've tried to tell her the importance of wearing N95 and those sorts of things, and talk to her about rapid tests, but even my own family, right, is not something that I can convince necessarily anybody of anything. And I feel like I'm yelling into a black hole a lot of the time, just trying to survive that and also keep my family alive. And I worry as time goes on, like, we're just going to see more people that are going to be impacted by it. And we still see people in denial of what it is, which is, it's hard. It's hard to watch that.
Especially when the science has come out saying that, hey, listen, if you actually have a HEPA filter or a CR box and you're wearing a proper respirator, N95 or a greater quality, during prolonged exposure to COVID-19, you can stay safe. Like, the science is out there telling everyone how to stay safe. Get yourself an N95 mask or an N99 mask.
That's the thing with this mask conversation, right, is I find it outrageous, because I'm like, if we could cut any transmission right now, if we could save any lives by us just masking indoors, what is wrong with us? Right? We saw the influence it had on flu deaths too, and like saving our elderly population. And instead of seeing that and taking that wonderful information that incidentally came to us to save the lives of these precious people that most of these people purport to celebrate on Remembrance Day, that we actually saved their lives with that. But instead of that, we went, nope. Instead of that, we'll just double the deaths with COVID now and ignore any precautions. And
because freedom.
Well, that's the thing, is it's harder and harder for it to be like touted it as freedom as time goes on, and it gets more and more frustrating to deal with individuals who won't face the consequences of their actions, right? And that's where the frustration comes from, is it's like, we can see the outcomes of this, and I, as a mental health clinician, look around and I'm like, the violence, the crime that we're going to see, like all the sorts of things that are related to the disintegration of our social systems. We've seen nothing yet, right, in the years to come, and looking historically, we know that too, is that there's so many outcomes associated with this to come, and we still have these people like Prasad. I'm just picking on him today because he's such a douchebag with that anxiety article. But when and all those sorts of people and Rasmussen, and who are just sort of willing to say whatever to get attention on themselves and don't really care about the impact or think about the impact or are too privileged to sort of dissect that impact. It's hard to watch them have so much power and not be able to do anything about it.
I was just thinking about what you were saying when you're talking about societal collapse and that horrific massacre yesterday in Saskatchewan, in northern Saskatchewan, in the Korean. I was just thinking, is this what it starts to look like when we stop caring about whether we become so dissociated from our community, when we have possibly psychosis, right, from a post-COVID exposure? Is this what it's going to look like? Because you're right, the increase in crime, the disassociation. Like, there was 13 crime scenes. There were like 13 crime scenes yesterday from the massacre yesterday.
If you don't believe that you have a community and you are told that, you know, selfish is best and our own survival is best, and these are values that we implement, yes, I believe that we absolutely see people that are going to do things more so because of those motivations. It's just... And we know that in sort of North American society, we're selfish, right? We are already individualistic, but now we've taken it to the point where we have, or not we, but our public health system has given our citizens permission to not care about genuinely sort of the life and outcomes of their fellow citizens, and to chalk it up to like, well, I'm having my personal responsibility. Well, that's not how it works with infectious diseases, right? Your risk is my risk. And that's the point, is that viruses do not move themselves. Viruses do not move themselves, right?
No.
We are moving the viruses. Our policies are driving whether we treat transmission or treat transmission less. We are making the choices with that. And we make the choice to not lessen that. And we have actively, for at least 2 years, been encouraging the mindset in our populations that that is okay, that this is the price of our freedom, that this is the price of capitalism, of sort of having these freedoms that we have in North American society, is sort of this individual assessment. Again, it's not possible for viruses for us to have that factor. That's why if someone showed up with hand, foot, and mouth disease, they'd be sent home. That's why a child with lice is sent home for treatment, right? And they have to come back after they've made sure they've had removal of all the things. It's not like they get to just stay, or they get to maybe just wear a hat some days, or maybe they'll take their hat off, right? Like, totally obscure things that make no sense in the context of community health. And if we're in a society, that's the point. We're not a society so that we're individuals. We're a society for societal benefit and for safety and for all those things that come with it. And that is freedom to me. That is freedom. Is having a community around me that cares about my safety, that has my back, that, that is part of my community. And it doesn't feel like we have that community anymore on a national, provincial, local level. We've made that community here. We've made that community on Twitter, on our various groups that have allowed us to come together across the last years. And in activism, that's always been the case, right? Is that we found each other in sort of these back channels and hooked up that way. But it's hard because it's become societal, like all of life now. And that sort of late back to what I said earlier of, I can't overlook someone's morals that they don't care if my grandma died of COVID. Right? That's not someone I want to sit down and have a conversation with.
Or I'm okay with orphaning this child. Do you remember, did you see that new report from the Imperial College of London about COVID-19 orphanhood?
Yeah.
And the numbers in Canada are, they're estimating there's 3,200 kids that have lost a primary caregiver to COVID-19, and it's going to at least double.
That's astronomical. And I say that as a child of someone who lost a parent, you know, at a young age, right? And my dad was 11 when he got sick, and 7 months later when I was 12, he died. And I am 34, and there's not a day that my father's death does not impact me now. There's not a day that I don't think about it. There's not a day that it sort of hasn't impacted the trajectory of my life, or that it ever will not, right? And I know that. And every child that's lost a parent, right, also knows that there is life before and there's life after. And we are minimizing the impacts and the losses that those will have for the lifetime of those children, right? It's not they're just being impacted by the death. It's they're impacted for the rest of their life and then their children's lives. And after that, right?
Intergenerational trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. Intergenerational impacts, right? My son is 17 and he has never met my dad, but he knows his name, right? He knows who he was. He knows that he would have loved him, right? And that's a good impact that it's had for me, but I've had a lot of resilience and ability to have access to things that gave me that. And many people won't. And that's not the impact it will have on their lives. I'm lucky to be where I am from a lot of privilege and a lot of luck and resilience at the right time. Many people who lose their parents do not end up in that similar circumstance.
No. No. And you just look at the fact that we are not protecting our children, that they could possibly be taking home the virus that could impact their lives permanently, where they lose a parent. You guys are worried about learning loss by not being in class. How about permanent learning loss, where a child is so traumatized and develops childhood depression because they've lost a parent, or they blame themselves for their parent getting sick or dying or being disabled?
Well, then why aren't we teaching our children that taking basic measures like wearing a mask and opening windows and building a Corsi Rosenthal boxing class to help our friends that are compromised, that do have family members that are compromised? Why is that not a goal? Where is our civic duty? Why are we not teaching our children about that while this is going on, instead of, you know, in various states burning the books about people, right? The priorities that we have right now in society are just so broken, and a lot of it is just encouraged by that individualism, right? It's pushing that more over the edge of like, yeah, I was right. I should have been treated better, right? I should have had that. I should have had this. And that pushes even more on the thinking equity is a loss and being angry that we're trying to give measures to people that will help them. Well, what do I get if they get something, right? It's pushing all of those sorts of notions, and we see that snowballing into what it is now, unfortunately, which is a collapsed healthcare system, privatization being talked about regularly in the media as if it's not a question, right?
Just
keeping it along, and the highest COVID deaths that we've sort of had, right? Like the level that we have right now and had for the last 3 weeks. You know, if I go to my COVID data, we had 33 in the last reporting period. That's going to go up. It goes up every week. But if we look to the 3 weeks before that, we had 44 deaths, 45 deaths, 45 deaths. The level in April before we took off was 40, right? Before we went up for another peak. And then it was dropped down to the 30s in June. And then we've been up since like August, up in the 40s. So what are we doing? We don't have control of this. A pandemic is not endemic. This is not seasonal. This is not something that we can just treat as if it's a cold or the flu, right? We don't have vaccines that target it in the same way. We don't have the same treatments. We can't just give Paxlovid to people every 3 months. Large amounts of compromised people who are the most at risk can't even take those drugs. So we're putting them in a position where they're not even going to have treatment if they get impacted, right? So it's wild to me that we sort of, we say that this is freedom. This doesn't look like freedom to me. And, you know, the people that say this is freedom are sure complaining about the delays at the airports. They don't like their freedom, apparently.
Or losing their luggage for 3 weeks. Oh, my gosh. Okay, yeah. What are you thinking freedom, traveling right now? Like, I want to ask these people. Like, you're literally sitting in a metal tube in 20,000 feet up in the air in recycled farts. And now it's recycled COVID and farts in a metal tube. Like, why would I want to fly right now?
Again, Mel, if we took their method of, like, personal risk assessment, okay, you decided that was your risk to get on a plane. But when you then go teach in your lecture hall, or you go and work in the hospital, or you go into the long-term care to visit your household member, and there are no protocols to really assess if you've been anywhere, if you have any symptoms, no one's doing that anymore, you go spread it and give an outbreak there. How is that fair? How is that public health? That's not personal risk assessment. That's a free-for-all Wild West, driving around at top speeds with no seatbelts on and saying that that's sort of living with it.
It's insane that they don't even report on COVID infections in school anymore, yet they will send a notice home for a lice and, you know, they'll forbid peanut butter, but a level 3 hazard, there's like no protocols put in place. It makes zero sense to me that we don't protect our kids from COVID the same way we protect them from peanut butter.
Well, it's like, why? I'll never fathom how it's not a goal, right? That teaching our children this is not a goal, that building community is not our goal, and we continue to sort of turn away from that every time that we have the opportunity to sort of build something like that. We turn from that. And by we, I mean generally people, because most of the non-privileged white people have figured out how to do community care long before we have. So directly, that the sort of North American populations of we've just gotten real ugly. We took the Band-Aid off. That's for sure. We took the Band-Aid off, and we are looking with full eyes at our population, and they are showing us what they think, and it's just not very nice what's looking back at us.
We drank the ugly Kool-Aid. Like, this is the worst version of ourselves. And that it's a choice. We have chosen to be the worst version of society possible in dealing with this crisis. We have chosen the worst option at every turn.
And encourage it. And glorify it. And put it on a pedestal. And not only that, but demean all the other ways of doing it, because if it's our way, it must be the best, right? And then we go after the zero COVID zealots, and then we go after anybody who potentially says that we could do it any other way. That is our way. And that is the individualism that we're pushing right now. And ain't it a thing of fucking beauty, man?
You see it manifesting in, like, a macrocosmic way, in the way how individualism and populism and fascism has literally taken up this whole entire personality, and people adopt that personality, right? And you see there's a certain profile of these people who adapt to this side, where they're usually anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, they're health fascists. Right, they believe, you know, oh, my genetics will protect me from a level 3 biohazard. Nothing will happen to me. I refuse to vaccinate. I refuse to wear a mask. It's all very specific personality type.
Well, there's literature on that too, right? There's literature about the personality characteristics of those that don't mask, of those that don't want to vaccinate. And I won't, like, I'm not going to talk about it too much here, but, you know,
it's please, not... like, please recap the literature out there about these personality types.
Well, right? it is those characteristics that you'd expect, right? Of like the not less community focused, a little bit more narcissistic, right? That they're not really thinking about the impacts of it on other people. And I think that's often what it comes down to, is the lack of perspective taking that these individuals have in dealing with others, is that and I made a tweet about this, I don't know, like a year ago, 18 months ago, I remember tweeting this and being like, these individuals genuinely, this like 2 weeks of them staying at home is like the worst thing that they've ever experienced. And they're looking at it from that lens and have such an inability to sort of make that lens flex or to change that lens to see how else it might be for somebody else, that they just sort of, they stop, they don't even try. And I can't imagine doing that, right? Like all I do all day long is try to perspective take, and I've done it my whole life. I love it. So I'm a psychologist, but the notion that we can get through this by just sort of depending on ourselves and our own knowledge and what we think is bonkers. Like, that's the thing, is it already is collapsed to the family and barrier, right? It already is collapsed to the families that have lost and are losing people to sort of not having the necessary services that they need, and are too afraid to get services because they're going to get infected in those settings. And I think we've come so far from where we were that it's easy to sort of want to feel or minimize what's going on. And to me, it's like, this is already collapsed, and it has been for some time, because, you know, we could depend on these services before someone, all of us, right? There's always been populations that didn't have access to this, but on a general level now, these services are inaccessible. And I don't know what happens with children in schools with the new variants. I truly don't know. I don't know what happens with the severity of the illness, if we're going to see that change. I don't know if we suddenly get a wave of long COVID that sort of follows the mass infection policies that we've seen. But I can say that we don't have the resources for long COVID, at least not in the systems that I'm seeing, because when we decided to go this route of, you know, endemic and not dealing with COVID, we sort of stopped the supply chain of working on the projects for long COVID too, and like just moving on with it. So I worry that there's just going to be so many people that are unable to access the services they need, that all the sort of stuff we've been seeing since March when we ended the precautions, that will just continue to escalate. So we'll just see it hit the bigger centers, right? We've seen it spread out from the rural districts into more of the health districts. And, you know, now we see UBC Vancouver. We'll continue to see some of the bigger centers get hit, unfortunately, because they're not going to be able to piecemeal the staff, right? They move people around and all that, but they're trying to get on their vaccine campaign right now, which is going to take staff. So I just think that it's going to continue in the way that it's continued. We're going to keep losing people. It's cumulative. So I hope that we don't see this, but, you know, we have the potential of seeing closures, I think, this winter, depending on what staffing looks like. But I don't want to see it, Mel. I want to smoke the hopium that all these other doctors are smoking and say that we're all going to be fine, because apparently that's what they say, despite all the evidence of everything and all the people still dying.
I really want to know how many families have been touched by loss during our public health crisis, whether it's overdose, how many parents have lost their children to tainted supply and found them OD'd and found them grieving their children, and how many families have lost loved ones to COVID. There, I don't think there's really been anything collected, has there, where people are able to just say, yeah, I lost someone.
And if anyone, oh yeah, the losses are going to continue to mount too, right? And I say mount, when I say mount, I sort of think of across COVID overdoses, suicides, and MAID, right? Like, I'm sort of thinking of all of those as we move forward in the future, because we have this economic crisis as well that's going to drive a lot of those other factors to increase. And because we have such a poor sort of system for, you know, PWD and those sorts of things, and we're seeing the change in MAID for the mental health stuff this year, I very much worry what sort of happens with that. And as you know, I fully support MAID. I don't support opening up MAID when you refuse to provide the basic necessities of life for people and then offer them that in a situation where they can't even find basic housing, and instead of giving them fucking housing.
Yeah, you know, you offer them death and you call it mercy. That's not mercy.
It's not mercy. Right, and then say that they consented to it. But yeah, it was like, but all they needed was a house, right? But you wouldn't give them the fucking house. Anyway, those are my worries moving forward, is that a lot of these factors are going to sort of hit. And my worry is the mental health crisis is going to be the front of that, right? Working now in the area of sort of psychosis and first episode psychosis, it's going to be interesting to see how that's impacted sort of in the coming years in terms of both through substance abuse but also through the development of disorders, and whether we see any sort of change with that.
The spike from post-COVID stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, the reason I wonder is because we do see sort of like that brain connections with the psychoses and schizophrenia like disorders. Mm-hmm. So, but we also see like the dementias and the other brain issues coming out through COVID. So I wonder if there's going to be something similarly veined in sort of psychosis like symptoms. And we did see mm-hmm. that in the beginning of the pandemic, we did have dementia and psychosis like symptoms. So I'm very interested to sort of see how that presents, but it does boggle my mind still that in many of these facets, including the stroke sort of injury area that I worked in, is that we're still not considering COVID, right? Like, we're not, in my mind, I imagine, like, one of the first questions we'd be asking right now for stroke is, like, when have you had COVID infections that you're aware of? Like, what is the time proximity to that? Yeah. Because we do have that research now about clotting and those in the stroke risk, but like in the stroke clinic, we still aren't even talking about that.
No, I think we're still a couple of years away from seeing it show up anything. I mean, I want to know what the data looks like in neuroscience for the developing brain and learning for children who have had repeat infections. What is it going to do to them?
That's sort of the scary data that I don't think we've started to look at, because to be honest, I don't think we want to know, scarily, is I do see some long COVID stuff starting now with kids, but in terms of the cognitive impacts on kids, I'm really not seeing a lot, which is concerning for sure, that we're just sort of, because we've approached it as like, this is mild for kids, we seem to be negating actually studying when it's not mild in kids, which is really worrying. And COVID, which is not surprising, is going down in the similar vein of some of the other physiological and mental health disorders that we've seen be treated poorly, like ME, CFS, right, and POTS, all those sorts of things that people are bypassing it as psychosomatic, even though we're seeing physiological things that you can test for. It's just tricky and harder than it is for other diseases. That we're gonna see a lot of people passed off to psych in the coming years. And so psych's gonna have to get really, really good at both advocating for and differentially diagnosing these sorts of issues in relation to long COVID and cognitive decline. But we're not talking about this, right?
Not at all. And the fact that we are purposely exposing children to something that leads to brain loss, it's scary, because I wonder how many kids are going to be diagnosed with learning disabilities, you know, after having multiple.
But even I just worry about like diabetes and autoimmune diseases, because like I already had them, so like there's already a proneness, and like immune issues my son already has, so like what kind of trouble are we asking for by him having this disease, right? It's like, I wouldn't try and give my child Epstein-Barr virus, right? Like, I would actively try and prevent that too. We've had the flu shot since he was a baby because we are trying to prevent respiratory illnesses because of his asthma. Like, it's not like this magically started with COVID. Many families were dealing with this before, but there weren't actions that society could or were willing to take at that time. And that's why COVID, we saw a lot of disabled and compromised people like, holy crap, maybe this is the time, like, we're being seen and people actually are paying attention to, like, the needs that we have and accommodations and accessibility and ableism. And then that moment passed and we ended up back where we are.
Yeah, now it's like, oh, you know, I bullied the Met for 2 years to not have to wear my mask to see an exhibit. Because, you know, right. Screw and, disabled
and,
people.
And doctors writing these asshat articles about not using the very few tools that we even have to sort of move forward and misusing psychological terms that he's had no training or expertise in. Just going to throw that out there in terms of, you know, telling people that they're anxious for protecting their health, which that's just poor doctoring. Poor doctoring, okay? Even in psychology, if we did think these things were psychosomatic, that would never be our approach with it. We would never be doing the things that these people are doing because it would cause psychological harm. So even if they believe that these are psychological issues, they're choosing to take actions to harm the people that are experiencing those psychological issues. So they should be thinking twice about what they're doing regardless, right?
Mm-hmm. But they're choosing harm. Every single policy choice is harm. There's no preventative action. There's no precautionary principle happening. It's harm.
Because their strategy is denial, right? If their strategy was actual moving forward or equity or the things that we're trying to look for and find solutions for, they would be working towards that, but they're not. So their strategy is denial because they don't have to deal with it. Right? They want to just ignore it. And that's what they're doing. That's why we see these conferences where it's sort of back to normal and all these things are, you know, Burning Man. And then I just saw.
I saw the Reddit
about the party that's like 40% down already with COVID, right? And
what did you think was going to happen at Burning Man?
But that's the point, Mel, is that they did think that was going to happen and they still did it. And that's what public health has done. But the problem is that because the system that we're in, that's not their risk. That's my risk. That's everybody's risk around them. That's the cancer patient in the grocery store when they decide to go there and get their groceries. That's the child who's coming out of the hospital with, you know, a disease that 85% will go on to live a perfectly okay adult life. But if an outbreak hits that ward, that we're going to lose 90% of those kids, right? That's unacceptable to put those risks out there. Yet, that is exactly the situation that people have been put in, and not only been put in, but encouraged to do and make poor decisions for.
The modeled lack of accountability. I mean, seriously, until the people take them to task and hold them accountable for their choices, we will continue to die quietly. The deaths will be brushed under the rug. People will be nameless. And no one should protect our children until these people are taken to account.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, people are like, why do you still do this? And I'm like, because when I die, my words are going to fucking haunt you. That's it.
Yeah.
That's all I have at this point, right? Is like, I have to live with a daily basis right now that most of the people around me are willing to give me a disease that could kill me because I'm immune compromised, that has hit me hard twice that they know of, and that they still continue to make these choices, right? That's the world I'm living in every day. So of course I'm a little fucking sassy right now. You'd be sassy too if you actually gave a shit, right? If you actually perceived. But you are mad that instead that I'm asking you to wear something over your damn face, right? Like,
and you're calling it lockdown. I'm asking you to put a respirator on, and you're perceiving it as lockdown.
Correct.
I was like, no.
And that's what I mean. So it's like when they ask me, like, what are you doing this for? Oh, why are you so passionate about this? I'm like, again, so when I fucking die, you have to listen to this and know that I was right. That it's going to be a tiny little puncture in your bubble of deniability, because most people I know me as an exceptionally honest person, as Twitter knows me, right? Like, I don't lie. I don't talk about things I don't think are true. I don't put things up that I don't feel that I have evidence for. So most people, when I do talk to them, they know I'm serious, and they don't ask me for answers unless they want the answer, because they know that it's going to be an honest answer. So the people I know that they have this feeling that they're doing something wrong when I talk to them. I know that because I can see that in them, right? And I know that at least if I die from this, that the people in my life will take a second look and a second listen, because they'll understand that I was right. Right? At least something could have that. It could change some minds, and there's evidence for other people to use. But again, that's the world we live in, where I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'll record this in case I fucking die.
That my words haunt you forever and it's recorded forever.
Because at the end of the day, the people who are vulnerable and compromised, we're just people. We're just people living normal lives. We're just people in jobs. We just happen to have an immune system that doesn't quite work for our side. We didn't act. Some of us were born this way. Some of us weren't and became over our lives. But we have to go about life in the same system as everybody else, except we're now in a system that has pretty much told us they don't care if it kills us, and they're not going to take the precautions to protect us from killing us, and they won't pay us to not kill us and stay home. So, some of us are pretty pissed right now, right?
And rightly so. Right, so.
Everybody that was in here tonight, we'll be posting this on our podcast once I can download it from Twitter, and we'll be doing another one in the future.
Yes, thanks everyone for being here. It was nice seeing everyone, and it was nice to get to catch up with you, Dr. Mundy.
Yes, thank you, Mel, and have a wonderful night. Everybody, stay safe out there.
Stay safe. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, thank you.